Tchias Amesim is where we're up to. Sometimes I feel that way about the attendance of our class that started with 40 people, but anyway.
It's a good class. Right. We're here.
I don't know if this is going to... Actually, this is what we had last week, and I don't necessarily know if we have any more to do on this source page, per se. Most of this we did, but if you want to keep them, you can. I have a new one for you for today. But we ended up with a whole bunch of questions last week about this notion of the resurrection of the dead, Tchias Amesim, and the Rambam, who really goes out of his way to talk about Tchias Amesim as absolutely critical to belief in Torah and in Judaism, and to the point where he has this language which is really unique amongst his expressions. He says, "Tchiyat ha-metim yisod mi-yisodot Torat Moshe Rabbeinu." This resurrection of the dead is a foundational principle of the Torah of Moshe. "Ein dat ve'ein kesher im ha'uma ha-yehudit l'mi she'eno ma'amin b'kach." Can be no religion and no connection to the Jewish nation for anybody who does not believe in this notion of Tchiyat ha-metim. "Ela shehu le-tzadikim." This notion is that the righteous will come back to life, etc. And then he wrote this whole article called Mamar Tchiyat Metim, in which he argues at length that there are other psukim in the Torah which we, if we wanted to, we could interpret metaphorically, allegorically, philosophically, but not this notion of Tchiyat Metim. This notion of Tchiyat Metim is unequivocal. It cannot be understood in any way other than literally. The soul comes back to the body, comes back to life. And we ended up with several questions, one of which is, why is Tchiyat HaMetim so central, so important, so critical to Jewish philosophy that the Rambam has this very harsh language? I suspect part of it's the polemic, that there were so many people who didn't believe in it that the Rambam felt he needed to write in this kind of harsh way. Nonetheless, it deserves attention. Number two, why was it that, on the one hand, so many people disagreed with it or didn't believe in it, and on the other hand, it was so central to Jewish life? And that's an incongruous scenario. And of course, the basic question, which is, what's it all about? What do I need it for? Why is it necessary as a part of the philosophy of Jewish thought? One of the challenges we have with Tchiyat HaMetim, it's a similar challenge to the notion of Olam Haba. What differentiates the belief in the world to come and the belief in Tchiyat HaMetim from belief in all the other 13 principles, including Imot HaMashiach, including the notion of Messianism, what differentiates them so profoundly is the fact that they have virtually no anchor in the written scripture or Torah Shebichtav. They're almost completely based on an oral tradition or the Torah Shebaal Peh. If you think about it, every one of the other principles that we talked about, whether it be prophecy of Moshe being uncontestable, a written Torah and an oral Torah, the notion of God being one, the notion of divine reward and punishment, even the notion of Messianism, is a theme that carries through much of the written Tanakh and then carries over into interpretation of the rabbis in the oral Torah. Whereas the notion of Olam Haba, the existence of the world to come, and the existence of this idea of the resurrection of the dead, has virtually no anchor in the written text of Tanakh. There's only one reference in Tanakh which is explicitly understood to be a reference to Tchiyat HaMetim in the future, and that we just finished discussing in the Gemara Shir, as I said to those to Mitch and to Stan, that this is a convergence of two Shirim that rarely come together, but in this particular instance we just finished this sugya in the previous Shir and we're doing it now. But the reference is to the Psukim at the very end of the book of Daniel. And there it says, the last chapter of Daniel, which reads, talks about some time in the future when the angel of Michael will stand over the people. V'rabim mishenei admat afar yakitsu, many of those who slumber in the dust of the earth shall awaken. Eile l'chaye olam ve'eile l'charafot l'diron olam, some to everlasting life and some to everlasting shame and contempt. Similarly, the last verse of Daniel is this Malach says to Daniel himself, Ata lech leketz v'tanuach. Now, Daniel, you go to your end, to your rest, v'ta'amod l'goralcha leketz yamin, and arise for your allotted portion at the end of days. So these two references are the only place in Tanakh we have this direct reference to the notion of those who slumber in the earth coming back to life. You, Daniel, go to your rest, you'll come back. Clear, explicit reference to this notion of Triyat Amitim. But outside of Daniel, there's no reference to it anywhere in Tanakh, and it begs the question, maybe for that reason that there was such skepticism about it, with a notion that's completely absent in the written scripture and yet is so much part of the Torah Shabbat Peh, that may have given rise to the objection to it, and at the same time to the polemic of the Rambam to defend it. So if I put the two extremes aside, I ask the question, why is it that it's not in Torah Shebichtav, and yet so central a theme to Torah Shebichtav, to Torah as a whole? So this question I saw addressed in an article by Rav Yaakov Medan in his book on Sefer Daniel. He has in the very last chapter, which you read the Sefer, his very last chapter, he deals with this issue of Triyat HaMetim in a very powerful, powerful way. And he says there are a number of things, but one of the conjectures that he offers is the following. He says that the reason why Torah Shebichtav omits the issue of Triyat HaMetim altogether, in a sense, is the same reason why it may omit the reference to Olam Haba altogether. Because from the very outset, Torah wanted us to take upon ourselves responsibility for the world that we live in. And the Torah wanted us to create a society that was moral and ethical, and that recognized the value of life. So what's the very first story in the Chumash? The moment Adam HaRishon leaves Gan Eden, what's the first calamity of society? Kain and Hevel. Meaning the first sin outside, post-Gan Eden, the very first sin of the act of that man commits is the act of murder. The concern with the existence of Olam Haba, belief in Olam Haba, and the concern with a belief in Triyat HaMetim, if it's referenced explicitly in Tanakh, if it's transformed into a theme that Tanakh, that the written scripture would identify, is that it can be distorted into a exoneration or a lessening of the depth of the evil of the act of murder. Human life has to be perceived in the Torah as the sacred value upon which everything else evolves. If the notion is that if you kill a person, that person is not really dead because there's Olam Haba, and is not really even physically dead because there's Triyat HaMetim, then you, in a sense, you lessen the impact of the act of murder, and you distort the values of a society. You create the potential for the lessening of the severity of that crime. And from that crime, everything else everything else grows from and develops. The value of the human life is directly related to the notion of the Tselem Elokim, the divine spark of the human being, and if killing a person isn't so terrible, and everything else gets distorted the moment you do that. And the truth of the matter is that, profoundly so, we know that there are societies in the world today for whom their definition of life and the value of life is very different from ours, because they live with this very real and tangible belief in the concept of Olam Haba for them, that allows them to take all kinds of liberties in Olam Hazeh that we would consider unethical and immoral. But they perceive it as some sort of interconnected, you know, the killing isn't so terrible because somehow life doesn't end here. So if life doesn't end here, so then killing somebody isn't such a terrible thing either. It suddenly distorts the whole value of life and death. So that's his theory as to why the Torah Shebichtav intentionally, which is so focused on the development of the responsibility for this world, ignores this issue. We talked about this a little bit when we did Kohelet. If you remember Kohelet, it was a long time ago. But if you remember our reference in the discussion Kohelet, I mentioned this other idea that Rav Meidan mentions in this book, that at the very beginning, the opening pasuk in Chumash, Bereshit bara Elokim et haShamayim v'et haAretz. In the beginning, it was God who created the heavens and earth. Bereshit bara Elokim et haShamayim v'et haAretz. So the word Shamayim is an interesting term. The Mefarshim struggle over what it means. One of the explanations of the word Shamayim is the Sforno, who says that it comes from the plural of the word Sham. One hand is Yad. Two hands, Yadayim. One foot, Regel. Two feet, Reglayim. The word Sham means there. If I double it, I get Shamayim. Rashi says it comes from the word Shamayim. There is water. Right? The world of water and the world of dry land. But the Sforno says it comes from the word Sham. That which is there. Meaning there's this world, Haaretz, this worldly physical existence, and then there's the Shamayim. There is the existence of the otherworldly domain. And the creation story begins with this creation of these two domains, Shamayim and Aretz. Now, from that opening passage, the next story should unfold is a description of the opening verse says, God created Shamayim and he created Aretz. That parallel should then continue with
description
of Shemayim, description of Aretz. The next verse reads, "Va'aretz etatov vavo." We never go back to Shemayim. Nowhere in the story of creation nor in the rest of Tanakh do we ever go back to the world of Shemayim. It's just there. Beyond that, we know nothing about it. Meaning, in this context, maybe that's what is going on. That this is. There's this world of Olam Haba and Triat Meitim and these sort of existences beyond the physical world we live in. The Torah makes reference to their existence in an allusion at the beginning in the hint, and that's it, because it doesn't want the Shamayim to be the central motif by which we define how we live our lives today, or distort the values by which we live our lives today. That's the theory. As to why it's so critically absent from the written Torah. The flip side of it is the other question, which is why is it so important to Chazal that we acknowledge this notion of Tchiyat HaMetim? Why was the Rambam so articulate about you can't have any foundational principle in Judaism without a reference to this concept of Tchiyat HaMetim? And there, Rav Meidan offers the flip side of the argument, which is that Tchiyat HaMetim is necessary because it goes back to the other foundation or the other beginning of the story of Bereshit. Namely, where was man created? Human being was created to put into Gan Eden. And Gan Eden was an existence of, essentially an existence which was anchored in two trees, the Eitz HaDaat and the Eitz HaChaim. We also talked about this a little bit in Kohelet. Actually, we talked about this a lot in Kohelet. There's the Eitz HaDaat and the Eitz HaChaim. The end of the story of Gan Eden is that when man usurps the authority of God by eating of the Eitz HaDaat, God says, "V'ata pen yishlach yado v'yacham Eitz HaChaim v'chaim le'olam." Now man will stretch forth his hand and consume of the Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life, and he will live forever. If he's usurped the power of the Eitz HaDaat to be the determinant of authority, then he needs something else to remind him that he is mortal, or that he is not God. And so mortality is introduced into the world. And that's the meaning of the verse, the day you eat of the tree, you will die. meaning not that you will die that day, but that you will introduce death into the world. So Adam, outside of Gan Eden, is mortal. Inside of Gan Eden, the pre Eitz Hadaat existence was some kind of immortal existence. Whether it was really immortal or whether it was just very long life, it's unclear. But it certainly was a pre Eitz Hadaat existence. The theory is that Adam, that man, through the process of Tchiyat HaMetim, comes back to Gan Eden, meaning that at no point in the entire description of the role of man through Torah, through mitzvot, through death and the din and before God and coming into Olam Haba, at no point does he ever come back to Gan Eden. He never returns to that physical, eternal existence. If he never goes back to Gan Eden, then on a very profound level, who wins, God or the Nachash? If God's intent for man was for man to be lived in, to live in Gan Eden, and the Nachash is the cause of his expulsion from Gan Eden, if he never gets back to Gan Eden, never in the history of the human being, in the history of the world, never gets back to Gan Eden, then on some very profound level, the Nachash wins. That's an intolerable scenario. And therefore, the very core of Torah is that somewhere this process has to lead man back to Gan Eden. So there's a simple version of that in Kohelet, which is to look at the Beit HaMikdash and to see the Beit HaMikdash as a kind of Gan Eden existence, where the Kodesh HaKadoshim is a replacement of Gan Eden. The Eitz Chaim Hilam HaChazikim Ba, the Kruvim that stand on the Aron, that represent the Kruvim that guard the access to the Eitz Hadaat, the entrance of the Kohen Gadol into the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur when man has become free of Chait. There's a miniature version of Gan Eden in the Beit HaMikdash. But that's a miniature symbolic representation of Gan Eden for the Jewish people, for one representative of the Jewish people alone. It does not reflect the totality of the human experience. The totality of the human experience, human being returns to Gan Eden when? When they're able to come back from death, when they're able to conquer death in the physical sense. And that's where Tchiyat HaMesim is so critical, to the point which in the Shemoneh Esrei. And we say it's the second bracha of the Shemoneh Esrei. And so these are the two extremes, if you will, almost contradictory ideas. And on the one hand, it's so central to Jewish thought because it's the answer to the Gan Eden story. And on the other hand, the Torah omits any reference to it because it didn't want the society to be built around this belief in Tchiyas HaMesim. It would distort the value of human life that we have, that we live by. So those are the two theories that Rav Meidan puts forward. I think they're very powerful and very compelling. And very interesting anchor to this whole story. The other observation that he makes is that this is really based on the Rambam. The Rambam very clearly disconnects Tchiyas HaMesim from Yemot HaMashiach. We talked about this last week. That whereas other Rishonim, the Ramban amongst them, sees the process as going from Messianism directly into Tchiyas HaMesim, that almost as if Tchiyas HaMesim is the culmination of the Messianic process. The Messianic process will bring Israel back to the land of Israel and restore the Beit HaMikdash and bring the dead back to life. The Rambam sees them as completely disconnected. History is such that we will go through this world. Yemot HaMashiach is to bring us back to where we were in the days of David HaMelech, in the days of Shlomo HaMelech, when we had a Beit HaMikdash and we had a kingdom of Israel. That's what Yemot HaMashiach is there for. It's the answer to the exile experience. It's not an answer. Tchiyas HaMesim is not part of that experience. Yemot HaMashiach brings us back to where we were supposed to be when we entered into the land of Israel. But now the question is, what was the purpose of the Torah and the Jewish people and the Beit HaMikdash in the land of Israel? Let's assume for a moment we never went into exile. We lived in the land of Israel with the king of Israel and with the Beit HaMikdash. We wouldn't have ever have had a need for messianism. Correct? But we'd always have a need for Tchias HaMesim. Tchias HaMesim is out there. It's the end product of human history. The goal, the reach, the purpose of Torah is to reach the end result of Tchias HaMesim. So it's not connected to Yemot HaMashiach. It's connected to human history. Yemot HaMashiach is to fix one of the blips of human of Jewish history, which is exile. But human history has a purpose. The Torah had a mandate to be fulfilled. Yemot HaMashiach allows us to fulfill a mandate. Great, but what was the mandate? It allows us to fulfill our mission. And what was the mission? The mission was to live a life of Torah and commitment to God that would ultimately bring the world to Tchias HaMesim. Because Tchias HaMesim is that restoration of the human being to the status of Gan Eden. So for the Rambam, Tchias HaMesim is not part of the Messianic process. It's separate from it, way down the future. Everybody with me? Now, there's very interesting textual proof to this idea. First of all, the page that I'm about to give you, can you follow the text?
I'm going to find her.
I'll give you another one, but if you can find, yeah. In the right-hand side, we're basically coming to a conclusion here. This is the end of our study of the 13 principles of faith. This is the last one. We have one more shiur, by the way, after this one. The review class, that will be after the break. But today we're going to bring it, sort of come to a conclusion. And if you look on the right-hand side of this page, it looks like this. You have here the text of the Shloshesve Ikarim, the Animami. And I remember I think I mentioned at the very beginning of the course that the Animamin was not written by the Rambam. The Rambam wrote his commentary on the Mishnah, in which he included the 13 principles as his commentary on the first Mishnah of the 10th chapter of Tractate Sanhedrin, if you remember the context. This Animamin was written many years later, but it reflects the themes of the Rambam. And if you look at the wording of the last two, I'll show you an interesting and subtle distinction. The second to last paragraph reads, in the context of Messianism, Ani ma'amin be'emunah shlema b'viyat ha-mashiach. I believe with the perfect faith in the coming of the Mashiach. Ve'af al-pi she'yitmamea im kol zeh achakela b'chol yom she'yavo. And even though he tarries, is delayed, we're still waiting, I will wait for him every day in anticipation that he could come today. Meaning that part of the belief in Yemot HaMashiach is the anticipation that it could happen tomorrow. And the desire that it happened tomorrow. Agreed? Now look at the wording of the next paragraph. Ani ma'amin b'emunah shlema shetiyet tchiyat ha-metim. I believe with the perfect faith that there will be a resurrection of the dead. Be'et shi'ya'ale ratzon me'et ha-borei yitbarach shemo. At a time of God's choosing. V'yit'ale zichro l'ad u'l'nesach nitzachim. God, whose name shall be eternal and whose name shall be remembered forever. I believe with the perfect faith that there will be a resurrection of the dead. When? When God so deems it. Be'et shi'ya'ale ratzon me'et ha-borei. Gone is any reference to waiting or any day. That whole theme of we wait for the Mashiach on a daily basis is missing in the context of the Tchiyat HaMetim. We're not waiting for Tchiyat HaMetim to happen. We're not asking for Tchiyat HaMetim to happen. It's part of a much more global historical sweep of the ultimate end game of human history. Yemot HaMashiach is directed to right now, my situation, where I am right now. I am a Jew in exile. I want to be a Jew in the land of Israel, living under the kingdom of Israel with the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, every day I wait for Mashiach, and I do whatever I can to make it happen. I don't do anything to make Tchiyat HaMetim happen.
But of course, you're alive.
We're not dead yet, right?
Right? But there are lots of people who are dead. Yeah, but, I'm not looking to bring them back to life. Yeah. Or I'm not even looking to daven that they should come back to life. Here's an interesting observation. We have, in the Shemona Esrei, we have 19 brachos. Those 19 brachos are divided into 18, but there's only 19. Right? Divided into three sections. The first section talks about things that are praise of God's power in the world, shevach. The middle 13 brachot are related to
wishes,
requests, things we want to happen, that we're lacking and we're asking for. The last three brachot actually are also related to things we want to happen. We call them hodah or thanksgiving, but they're actually also requests. They're just more generic. We ask for the Beit HaMikdash, we ask for the Avodah, we ask for peace in the world. So we have 16 brachot of requests, and 3 brachot which are designed specifically not to address any requests, they're just acknowledgments of God's power in the world. Okay. In the requests that we make of God in the middle brachot of the Shemoneh Esrei, right? There are several references to Yemot HaMashiach. You are aware of that, correct? The Shemoneh Esrei contains many references to the request for messianism. So we say, Taka b'shofar gadol l'cheriteinu, God, blow the great shofar of our redemption, v'kabtzeinu yachad, gather us together into our land. We make a request to bring us back. We talk about returning to Yerushalayim and rebuilding it b'karov b'yameinu, in our days, v'chisei David mehera l'tochatachin, and the seed of David, the throne of David, quickly reestablish. Why mehera? Why quickly? Because every day we want Mashiach to come, and we want Kisei David to be restored. In the next paragraph, Et tzemach David avdecha mehera tatzmiach, the seed of David, your servant, quickly grow, raise up his crown, the karnot v'mushuatecha, kilushuatecha kivinu kol hayom, because we wait for your salvation every day. B'chol yom, we're waiting for Mashiach. In these 19 brachot, there is not a single, in these 16 brachot of requests, there is not a single request for the Tchiyat HaMetim. There's requests for health. There's never a request to restore the dead to life.
But it mentions Mechayim Esim.
Correct.
In the beginning.
Where?
But that's part of his power.
Correct. The only place we have a reference to Tchiyat HaMetim is the second brach of the Shemoneh Esrei. So it's not that it's absent from the Shemoneh Esrei, it's prominent. We have an entire bracha in the Shemoneh Esrei designed to talk about Tchiyat HaMetim. Baruch Ata Hashem Mechaye HaMetim. But there the reference is, V'ne'eman Ata L'Hachayot Metim. You are trusted to revive the dead. Mekayem Emunato Lishene Afar. You who keep your faith with those who sleep in the dust. We trust that it will happen. There's never a request for it, and there's no reference to speed. At some point, it's part of our belief system because it's part of our understanding that human history has to come back to Gan Eden. But it's not part of the daily routine by which we live our lives. It's not something which will become a component of the value system of how we live. Because if it would, it could potentially distort the value of life. So it's there as part of the great power of God, not as part of the requests of that which we desire and hope and work towards in our lifetime. I found the idea in the very compelling, and very so I thought I would share it with you. Excuse me?
I think it is. It's better explained. A lot of times it's just like, you know, we're not going to talk about it.
Right. Because we don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
That's right. We don't know what to do with it. And I've always intuitively felt that Tchiyas HaMesim had somehow connected us back to Gan Eden. I think this article just put it into concrete terms for me that I was struggling with before.
It's interesting with the wording with Mashiach and Tchiyas HaMesim. Of course, Mashiach is going to come at a time that God chooses for him to come.
Or when we bring the process sooner. Yes, it may.
But even still, with our bringing it, it'll be God deciding, okay, this is the time they've met their end of their bargain. I mean, we don't know what really is our end of the bargain.
But it still has a reference to it happening in our lifetime.
Yeah. We're thinking it could come soon.
Right. It's still,
and there's something we can do.
We're still watching it unfold. It's in our lifetime. Yeah. It's something which happens in this world. It's this worldly focus. It's about Malchut Shem and Malchut Yisrael. It's about the kingdom of Israel. It's about who we are as a people here in the here and now. It's concrete. Whereas Tchias HaMeisim is about the end of human history. How long is the world going to last? Who knows? Thousands of years? We have no idea when Tchias HaMeisim is going to come. The Rambam's philosophical position is that Tchias HaMeisim could come any time in the future after Yemot HaMashiach. A year after Yemot HaMashiach, 1,000 years after Mot HaMashiach, 100,000 years after Mot HaMashiach. No connection. Other Rishonim differ, Rashi, Ramban, differ. They connect the two. One leads directly to the other. Messianism leads to Tchias HaMeisim. That's the whole, Ramban's whole philosophy is that Messianism transforms nature, conquers nature, brings us back to Gan Eden. Whereas the Rambam says, no, Tchias HaMeisim does not bring us back to Gan Eden. Yemot HaMashiach does not bring us back to Gan Eden. Yemot HaMashiach brings us back to Kingdom of Israel and Beit HaMikdash. Those two combined with Israel and loyalty to Torah will eventually bring all of human history back to their goal of Gan Eden, but that'll take a long time. Okay? We have 20 minutes left. Another 20 minutes... No, actually we have 35 minutes left. 9:30 we finish, right? 35. Okay, so we have 35 minutes left. In the time remaining, if we finish a few minutes early, we will. I want to show you the Rambam's two conclusions. And I say two conclusions because you can't read one without the other. If you do, you get a distorted picture. They're really remarkable. Remarkable conclusions. What on this page, on the front of this page that you have here is Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva and a few other places where sort of collected a summary of all of these different principles from other writings of the Rambam. I'm going to skip all of that. We're going to go straight to his concluding paragraph of the 13 principles themselves, which in the top paragraph here in the Rashi script, we're not going to stay there long, but you see where it says Hayisod Shloshasa Tchiyat HaMetim Ukvar Bi'arnuha. I've already explained this Tchiyat HaMetim concept for you. And now he concludes, V'kasher yamina adam el ha-yisodot. When you believe in these principles, he's now in his concluding paragraph of the entire 13 principles of faith. To make life a little simpler, if you turn the page over, I've given you the text from the Kapach edition of the Rambam, which is much easier to read. So at the top of this page, this first part at the top, which says, Sanhedrin Perek Asiri Perek Chelek. Again, this is the Rambam's conclusion of the passage, the treatise on the 13 principles of faith. This is how he ends them. Okay? V'kasher yu kayamim la'adam kol ha-yisodot halalu ve'emunato behem amitit. When a person fulfills all of these principles and his trust in them is complete, harayu nichnas b'chla Yisrael, such a person can enter into the category of Israel. V'chovah le'ehavo u'lachmol alav. We are obligated to love such a person and to have compassion over such a person. And all the things that the Torah commands us about loving our neighbor and brotherhood and tranquility. And even if a person should sin, because of the Yetzer Hara gets the better of him, nobody's perfect, everybody commits sins from time to time, he may be punished according to his portion, according to his actions, whom you push Israel, he may be a sinner of Israel, but he's still part of the Jewish people. And we have a mitzvah to love him and to care for them, because even though a person may sin, as long as they believe in these 13 principles, they're part of the Jewish people. But kasher yifakpek adam biyisod elu hayisodot, but if a person should doubt the veracity of any of these principles. Harei ze yatsa min haklal, such a person excludes himself from the community of Israel. The kafar bi'ikar, and he is rebelled against the foundational principles of Jewish life. V'nikra min v'apikores v'kotzetz b'netiyot, and we can throw all kinds of names at such a person. Heretic and apikores. And we are obligated to hate such a person, to try to destroy such a person. I will hate those who hate God. Harsh language for the Rambam. And then he goes on. Ukva he'erachti b'dvarim ma'od. I have spoken about these things at great length. V'yetzati m'inyan chiburi. I've digressed from my primary purpose of my composition. Remember, what's he writing here? What's his primary purpose in this composition? Commentary on the Mishnah. He's writing a halachic commentary on every Mishnah and its conclusion according to the concluding discussions in the Talmud, which will become a precursor to his later work called the Mishnah Torah, or his Code of Jewish Law. Ela she'asiti ken, lefi she'ra'iti she'zeh to'elet be'emunah. But I have done so, I have taken this digression, because I have seen great value for the purpose of faith, of increasing faith in the world. Levishani asafti lechadvarim rabim mo'ilim, I have gathered for you in this treatise, in this book, very great and effective ideas, hamefuzarim b'chiburim rabim gedolim, scattered throughout the Talmud. What the Rambam does in his 13 principles is he takes ideas which, up until the time of the Rambam, there was no book of Jewish philosophy. If you wanted to understand all the different components of Jewish philosophy, you had to read through the whole Talmud and the Medrash and all the works of Chazal and try to distill from them the core values and ideas of Jewish philosophy. What the Rambam has done is he's gathered them all together. V'chazor al dvarai eile pa'amim rabot. Review my words here many times. V'itbonen behem hetev, and study them well. V'im tashle otcha machshvotecha, shekva hevanta inyanav mipam achat o eser, and if you will delude yourself into thinking that by reading them only once or even 10 times you understand them, Hashem yodea shebesheker hishleta otcha, God knows that you have deceived yourself. Alta meherbo, don't read them through quickly. Lefishani lo katavtiv echshaniz damen, I didn't write down whatever came to my mind. Elachar hitbonenut v'yishuv hadat, but only after careful analysis and understanding. V'iyun b'deot nechonot b'lti nechonot, and careful analysis of correct ideas and incorrect ideas, v'sikum ma shetzarich la'amin behem, and a conclusion of the summary ideas of that which a person is obligated to believe in, u'birurom b'ta'anot v'ra'ayot al kol inyan v'inyan, and with proof and proof texts and proof arguments for every single matter, u'me'et Hashem esh'al l'nachoteini b'derech ha'emet, and I've asked God to help me, to lead me in the path of truth, and now I can go back to writing what I was intended to write about, which is the halachas of this parak. So there's the Rambam's conclusion. Conclusion number one is that these are such foundational principles that if you deny them, you write yourself out of the script. You write yourself out of the script. There's a special script called the script of Israel, the book of Israel, book of the Jewish people. And it's defined by these 13 principles. If you deny them, you write yourself out of the script. A person can be a terrible sinner, but he doesn't write himself out of the script. He believes he's just weak. His Yetzer Hara gets the best of him. So out of a moment of weakness, of Teyavon, of Taiva, he sins. That such a person is part of the Jewish people, and he doesn't write himself out of the script. And we have a mitzvah to love them and have compassion over them for their sins, but nonetheless to love them. Whereas a person who actively stands up and intentionally with full knowledge of his actions denies these 13 principles, says there's no Torah in the Shemayim, Torah is not divine, Torah is not written by God, Torah, there's no reward and punishment, there's no Tchiasim, whatever the issue is, such a person writes himself out of the script. That's conclusion number one. Conclusion number two, I find even more astounding than conclusion number one. Conclusion number one, I think, is typical for the Rambam, and we would not write in this fashion today, but nonetheless, I think it's not atypical for the Rambam's worldview. Conclusion number two is really astounding. What's his second conclusion?
He's got the answer, and he knows it.
And he's got the answer, and he knows it. And don't think that you can understand this by reading it once or twice, even 10 times. You really want to understand this, you've got to spend a lifetime reading this. You've got to go over it and over and over it, understand it in greater depth, because I've collected it from all over Shas. I've pulled the ideas together from all over the place. You wouldn't be able to know where to start with this stuff. I put it here for you. It's all there. Now go and learn it. And don't delude yourself into thinking that by reading it once through, even over a course of a year and a half, we understand all there is to understand about it.
There's a little bit of pride there.
Amazing, isn't it? Isn't it amazing? Now, the reason why I think it's so astounding and so amazing is because not only is it atypical of the Rambam, but he has another conclusion in which he concludes his entire treatise of this commentary on the Mishnah, which is almost the exact opposite. And if I were to stop here, and this is all we'd have, we'd all come away with a smile about the arrogance of the Rambam, which is why I absolutely refuse to look at that passage without the sister passage, which is the one on bottom. Again, the Rambam wrote this large treatise called the Commentary on the Mishnah. It's a work of astounding compilation in which he takes every Mishnah in Shas and comments, explains it according to the conclusion of the Sugya and the discussion in the Talmud. So if you have 20 pages of 20 folios of Talmudic discussion on the Mishnah, he'll take the conclusion and writes it into his Commentary on the Mishnah. That's what it's for. It's designed to be the halachic conclusion for every Mishnah in as you go through the Mishnah. So you study the Mishnah, and you know what the conclusion of the Gemara is. Later, he translates, he expands on that when he writes his magnum opus called the Mishnah Torah. And in the very end of the last tractate, of the last chapter, of the end of the Mishnayos of Taharos, very last part, he has the following Chatima, where it says in the middle, on the bottom, it says Chatima. This is his conclusion. We have now completed this entire work as we had intended. And behold, I pray and beseech God that he should spare me or save me from any possible error. You already get, right from the opening sentence, a very different tone than in his previous section. And if anybody finds any place in this entire treatise, in this entire work, place to argue, or if somebody finds in any comment on any Mishnah a better interpretation than the one that I have offered, Ya'irakach, he should be welcome to say so. Let him make that observation. V'yadineni l'schut, and at the same time, let him judge me favorably. Meaning, if you read a Mishnah, and your understanding of the Mishnah and the Sugya and the Gemara leads you to a different conclusion than me, then first of all, say so. And second of all, don't blame me. Don't be harsh on me, says the Rambam. Don't take it too harshly on me. Give me the benefit of the doubt. Why? And this is really where it gets remarkable. Because the task that I have taken upon myself, it's not a small task. And it's not something which can easily be achieved, if you understand what's going on. Meaning, he acknowledges that he has undertaken an immense task. Understand that the problem with codifying the Talmud is that every discussion in the Talmud is connected to discussions everywhere else in the Talmud. If you ever study Gemara, you know that there's a kind of stream of consciousness that runs one subject into another. So if you want to discuss sugya in I don't know, whatever the halachic issue is, we're going to topic Masechet Rosh Hashanah, we're learning about tithes. You need to be able to not only understand the sugya in the Gemara, but you also need to be understand all of the references to that discussion elsewhere in Shas. You need to be able to almost commit the entire thing to memory so that you can cross-reference everything throughout the Talmud, which is the size of the, textually, the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's enormous. And then you need to be able to kind of put it through this computerized brain of cross-reference so that you can draw your conclusions. And this is, it's an enormous task. And it was the first time anybody had ever tried to do something like this. The Rambam, remember, is the first of these kinds of codifiers. There are commentaries on the Mishnah that predate the Rambam, but none of them are designed to bring the halachic conclusions from the Gemara. That was a unique of the Rambam. So he acknowledges that he's undertaken an enormous task. Ubifrat, not only have I taken on an enormous task, but in addition, I recognize I have often been distracted during this period of time. Now what could possibly be distracting the Rambam?
All those moves.
I've been distracted during this time. From the decrees that God has placed upon us of the exile. And moving through the world. From one end of the globe to the other. May this galut be an atonement for all of our sins already. Shrein genug, as they say. God himself knows. Today we would write, God only knows. God himself knows. Ki yesh halachot mehem shekatavti perushan b'masa'oti b'drachim. God knows that I wrote some of these halachot while we were traveling on journeys. U'mehem inyanim v'shamtim b'yoti al gabei ha'oniyot b'yam ha'gadol. I wrote some of these halachot while we were traveling the ships in the great sea. V'dai b'matzav zeh. And that in and of itself would have been sufficient were it not for the additional headache. V'nasaf al hayoti me'ayen b'madaim acharim. In addition to the fact that I use the same time to study other disciplines of knowledge. Science and philosophy and medicine, Aristotle. That same period of time that he was traveling with his father and learning Talmud and Mishnah and writing the commentary in the Mishnah is the same period of time he was learning science and philosophy and medicine. So his time was divided, and he couldn't spend all of it doing everything. So not only is he tarud, is he distracted, and not only is he traveling, not only does he have the hardships of the journey on boats and on donkeys and traveling from one end of the world to the other, he's also studying science and medicine and philosophy during the same period of time. So give him a break, give him some credit of benefit of the doubt that if he made a mistake, not so terrible.
He didn't go to bed at 9 o'clock.
he wrote a letter.
He has a very famous letter. I think I read it at the very beginning of the course. People knocking on the door all day and him not having time of day, and he eats once a day. Now, why did he tell me all this? He says, "V'loti arti et hamatzav." I didn't describe this so you should have compassion on me. I only described all this kidei lahasbir hitnatzluti, so you should understand my apology. In case somebody would read this and see something that he thinks is wrong, he shouldn't think, how could the Rambam write something that's wrong? Right? So first of all, don't be critical of him for his critique of me. God should reward him for being critical. If you want to be critical of me, I love you. I love you for it. He's beloved to me. He's engaged in God's work. I'm engaged in God's work. מה שתיארתי במצבי במשך זמן חיפור פירוש זה הוא שגרם שנשתהיתי בזמן רב. But you should know that the fact that I took so long to write this thing, it's also because I've been traveling. It took me a full 7 years to write this thing. אני משה בלב מימון, הדיין בלב יוסף החכם, בלב יצחק הדיין, בלב יוסף הדיין, בלב עובדיה הדיין, בלב שלמה הרב, בלב עובדיהו הדיין, זכר קדושים לברכה. There's your Yichus tree, by the way. Right? משה בן מימון, הדיין, בן יוסף החכם, בן יצחק הדיין, בן יוסף הדיין, בן עובדיה הדיין, בלב שלמה הרב, בלב עובדיה הדיין. So interesting, who's a dayan, who's a rav, and who's a chacham in his lineage?
Joseph is the chacham.
Yeah, I would say he has different titles for each one. So obviously they had different. These aren't just arbitrary titles; these are significant.
That other people would have recognized these people,
yeah.
I presume.
Sure. Hitchalti lechaber perush zev ani ben shalosh ve'asrim shana. I started writing this when I was 23 years old. Vishlamti oto b'mitzrayim v'ani ben shloshim shana. And I have now completed it in Mitzrayim. Remember, he starts to write it when he's leaving because of the Almohad conquest. He finishes it when he gets to Mitzrayim at the age of, ripe old age of 30. Shehi shnat 1409 v'shivim l'shtarot baruch ha'natan li'ayev koach u'le'en onim otzma yarbeh. Blessed is he who gives the weary strength.
Man, I'm tired just listening to that.
I find it the most remarkable conclusion to any book. Can you imagine writing a book? Any book, Halacha. And at the conclusion of this book you write, and if you read this and you think that I've made a mistake, don't be too harsh on me. I've been traveling, I've been learning science, I've been studying medicine. So don't be so hard on me. Remarkable, remarkable passage. But at the same time, I think it also balances a little bit of the harshness of his paragraph at the end of the 13 Principles, where he says, this is it, guys. I wrote it. Take it or walk away now. Kind of softens that blow a little bit, I think, with this conclusion of the whole piece. And with that, I think we have come to the end of our formal study of the 13 Principles of the Rambam.
Have high-level people found mistakes in his work?
Well, there are always critique. In other words, in the Mishneh Torah? Or in the 13 Principles? In the Mishneh Torah, look, we show him, argue with him all the time. Not so much mistakes, as much as different opinions, different interpretations. We show him, you know, the commentary on the Mishneh is one approach. It's the Rambam. The Ramban, Rashi, and the other Rishonim, they differed all the time on halachic issues.
But nothing that we would call a stupid mistake.
No. The Rambam didn't do anything that was so stupid, and he certainly didn't make...
It seems
it's
like
easier if you have something. He wrote it down, so the people who come after, you've got a framework.
Right. I mean, there were commentaries before him, but not codifiers. Like Rashi's commentary is before the Rambam, but Rashi didn't write a codification. He wrote a commentary line by line. Mm-hmm. The notion of codifying, which is to take the totality of the corpus and then reorganize it in your head without computers.
That's
an undertaking that's remarkable.
It seems like one of the different. It's interesting because at the end, there is kind of an apology, but on the other hand, it's the understanding that this is my interpretation, and there could be another But the first one is, if you don't believe this, forget an analysis of everything else. So I'm not going to yield on these 13. These 13. You're not even going to talk to me if you're not coming from these 13.
Correct.
If you're coming from the 13, then we can have a discussion. We can sit at the Shabbos table, and we can argue.
Right.
But if you're not going to hold with the 13, I don't choose to hear anything you've got to say.
Correct.
Because it's not going to hold water because you don't believe in these basic principles. Right. So he wasn't willing to yield an iota on those. After you decided we're all believing this together, okay, we'll have a discussion about the rest.
100% correct. Absolutely.
So and I think that still holds.
That still holds true today. In other words, what defines, what differentiates the 13 principles of faith from the rest of the halachi material that he's presenting here, is the framework. What the 13 principles gives you, I call it the puzzle frame. It gives you the framework of Jewish thought, philosophy. It gives you the framework of the halachic principles and of the halachic method. Now, we can argue vociferously and till, you know, we can argue forever about whether this verse means that halacha or that halacha comes from this verse or whether this halacha is correct or that halacha is correct. We can argue those points till kingdom, you know, till somebody codifies it and puts in it makes it draws a conclusion. But that's assuming that we're both coming from the same frame of reference on how halacha operates, on the theology of halacha, the principles that define Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaalpeh, the oral Torah, the transmission process. Those define the framework upon which all our discussion is framed. If I don't start there, then we end up with very strange kinds of arguments. We end up with arguments about whether Torah is man-made or God-made. I can't argue the laws of Shabbos if our understanding of the source of these laws is so profoundly different. If you believe that laws are man-made, and I believe the laws are God-made, then our discussion about the laws of Shabbos are not operating in apples and apples. So we have to first establish the framework upon which the halachic universe operates, or within which the halachic universe operates. And then we can argue halachic points as much as you want. So I think your distinction between these two passages is absolutely correct. One is framework piece, where the Rambam is very rigid and very harsh, because he's dealing with the foundation, and the other is the commentary of the Mishnah, which is a major undertaking for a guy at 23 years old traveling from one end of the globe to the other, and he acknowledges it. When he wrote his magnum opus called the Mishnah Torah, with this 14 volumes of the codification of the totality of Jewish law, which he wrote in Egypt, he puts in no such apology. But it's still remarkable. Okay. We will conclude here. We have one more class. And what I want to do in the one more class, I'll actually send out an email about it to the show, because really, even people who weren't part of the course, I think, could benefit from it. What I've done in the last class is, I do it as a PowerPoint. Basically, a graphic depiction of all 13 principles and how they relate to each other. Is it simply 13 ideas scattered from across Jewish texts, or did the Rambam have some kind of structure in mind when he wrote them, these ideas and not others, and in this sequence? And given the nature of the Rambam's analytical mind, I've always felt very strongly that they have to have a structure. They can't just be arbitrary ideas that the Rambam picked the 13 most important. And so what I try to do is work through what that structure is. To the best of my understanding and my humble limited understanding, I have not been through these 13 even 10 times. So when the Rambam says 10 times isn't enough, I'm not even there yet. So we're still
in. To prepare for the class, you probably went through it 100 times. No, seriously. Right.
But be that as it may, we're going to try to do that. That'll be.